Most of the members are speaking up. We have a situation where four of our members are still on sick leave. So members will just bear with us that those that are there will just have to operate on overdrive. And it still is a committee. I also want to appeal to the DA not to take advantage of their numbers at some point. Okay, without wasting time, today we're going to be taking submissions from the Banking Association of South Africa. After the Banking Association, we'll have the Principal Officers Association, and after that take the Life Officers Association, and then take a discussion after that. And we'll collect for tea after that, take the Association of Collective Investments, and then the Association of Trust Companies in South Africa, and discuss and close. I would like to appeal that presenters try and stick to the 20 minutes allocated for presentations in order to be able to finish. But then once again, to repeat our request that when the bells ring again, we will just have to be rude and guide down at the better time. So even if it's in the middle of the presentation, it's very good. Okay, we have Mr. Keskovadia from the Banking Association of South Africa.
Thank you, Chair. And again, thank you for the opportunity for presenting before you. You members have our detailed submission. What I'm going to do is just take members through a PowerPoint quickly, just pointing out some of our critical issues. I've got with me three people sitting somewhere in the back there. Audrey Krobler, who's a consultant to the Banking Association on these matters. Art Jury over there, who's our national payment system person, and Nikki Lala Mohan next to him, who's general manager for market conduct. And so I'll make the noise and they'll answer the question. There are five critical aspects in our submission, which is of concern to us. So one is the inspection of affairs and removal of documents. The other is details of on-site visits, the details requested during on-site visits. Then issues related to fit and proper conduct. Then suspension, withdrawal of the faith authorization of banks, that is being dealt with in the amendments. Compliance officers not being same as auditors, and some thoughts on that. So I'll concentrate my summary on those five areas, and I'll also comment on the both provision to amend the national payment system. The inspection of affairs and removal of documents, section 45.5 of the amendment bill and subsections A2 and B1AA are relevant in this regard. Our view is that the provisions here are too wide and in certain instances outside the scope of the FAITH Act and in areas not regulated by the FAITH Registrar. And you will recall, Chair, that when we were here last week or 2 weeks ago on the FICA issues, we also raised a concern that in that case the FICA office and the regulator there was also intending to actually go beyond the FICA regulation and go beyond the regulatory authority of the FICA office. And this is a concern for us today as well, that there seems to be regulatory creep and also crossing over into other regulatory terrains. We would suggest that the relevant section be amended to ensure the information requested is FAITH-related. And limited to that. And our suggested wording is under paragraph 2.1.1 on page 2 of our detailed submission. I'm not going to repeat the wording here. members have it. But our critical concern there is the powers are too wide, go beyond the FACE Act, and they are in areas not regulated by FACE. Then the on-site visit, Section 45.7 refers here. Our concern here is that the description referring to the details is again too wide, and that we suggest the details required should be more specific, and that the regulator must actually specify what sort of details are required during on-site visits. And again, our suggestion is contained in paragraph 2.1.2 of our detailed submission. But again, the general trend here seems to be that it's just too wide. It's going beyond the ambit of this particular regulator and this particular act. The foot and proper issues, this is an amendment to Section 8 of Act 37 of 2002, and Section 47 of the amendment bill refers. This amendment, in our humble opinion, does not factor in the fact that the prime regulator of banks is the Registrar of Banks. The Banks Act does place stringent fit and proper requirements on banks. And again, I at the risk of sounding like a bit of a stuck record, but I think I do need to continue to repeat that again, there seems to be a trend in the regulatory process, not just in FACE, but FICA last week and others, that regulations come to the fore under particular regulators, and people just tend to forget that there are regulators already governing some institutions. And we would humbly put to the committee that we need to take that into account, and there needs to be some sort of coordination and recognition. Again, we would recommend that this section should either exclude banks from fit and proper requirements, but we would also suggest that at the very least, a mechanism for coordination between the different regulators be found. To impose fit and proper requirements outside of the Banks Act on banks, while they do have fit and proper requirements under the Banks Act and governed by the banking regulator, we believe it's not only just unreasonable, we believe it's not proper. And our recommendation in this regard under paragraph 2.3.1 of our details submission. The suspension withdrawal of FACE authorization of banks, this is related to substitution of Section 9 of Act 37 of 2002 and Section 48 of the amendment bill refers. Once again, this section does not take into account that banks are primarily regulated by the Registrar of Banks. We submit this section be amended to make it incumbent on the FACE regulator to consult with the Registrar of Banks and other relevant regulators before any action is taken under this. And I can only speak for banks because I'm representing banks here. Banks are highly regulated institutions. Reputational risk issues are serious issues for banks and for this country and the economy. And we believe that if another regulator has the powers of suspension and withdrawal of authorization and licenses and so on without actually coordinating with our primary regulator, it actually opens up the sector to all sorts of reputational risk and other risk issues. And we believe that the committee should consider that. Again, we have suggested wording to this effect under paragraph 2.4.1 of our detailed submission. The issue of compliance officers. This is amendment to Section 17 of Act 37 of 2002, and our submission is related to Section 55 of the amendment. We would suggest the reporting requirements contemplated under this section are again too wide and too onerous, and we would further suggest the wording be changed to require compliance officers to report on matters having a bearing on the FACE Act and not beyond. If the FACE regulator has issues that she picks up or he or she picks up and would like to be dealt with and are being dealt with under other pieces of legislation, under the auspices of other regulators, then talk to that regulator. Don't reinvent the wheel in a new piece of legislation. So we believe, we would contend that, again, the wording be changed to limit the compliance officer to report a matter related to things, because we report to the banking regulator on other matters, we report to the national credit regulator on matters, we report to FICA on matters. We pretty soon will be reporting to the housing department on housing matters. And it goes on and on. So our recommended wording in this regard is in paragraph 2.8.1 of our detailed commission. So those are the five critical issues, Chair, specific issues. Then there's the suggested amendments to the NPS Act. And these amendments seek to facilitate entry of non-banks into the national payment system. Now, this has been an ongoing debate for a while. I think it's also something that the Competition Commission inquiry into the payment system is looking into. Now, the Banking Association, and I think we just need to put on the table very clearly that we would agree that the area of financial intermediation has progressed to an extent that requires consideration of entry of non-bank institutions into the payment system. We can't pretend anymore that only banks do financial intermediation. Supermarkets are doing financial intermediation. Cell phone companies are doing financial intermediation. Microlenders to a certain extent. Some of the larger ones do. I think that needs to be recognized, and we need to look at some form of entry for non-bank institutions. However, we would ask your committee chair to consider any possible risks to an internationally recognized and accepted national payment system. Now, we're not for in any way contending that any non-bank institutions that come in will bring risks. But what we are saying is that the national payment system up to now have been the domain of banks. And banks are highly regulated institutions. And so any risk areas can be addressed fairly effectively and efficiently if those risks come up. Now, the non-bank institutions at this point in time are not regulated to the extent that banks are in the financial intermediation area. And so the possibility that they could bring risk because they are not regulated to the extent that banks are is certainly there. And all we are saying is that the committee needs to consider any possible risk. We have a national payment system that's internationally recognized and accepted, and we need to, in the interest of the country, ensure that is protected and enhanced. We also believe there are numerous regulatory issues to be considered in opening up the system, and we would urge the committee to consider these. So it's not just saying, okay, we're opening up the system, but we also then need to ask, how do these non-banks need to be regulated to participate in the payment system? We need to look at some issues of level playing field between these non-bank institutions and banks in the national payment system. So I think there are a whole range of issues to consider. Our support for the entry of non-banks, together with our suggestion that the committee insists this be managed so that any potential of introducing undue risk into the NPS is contained and can be found under paragraph 1 of our details. So the gist of that, Chair, is that agree consideration of non-banks entering the system, but manage it well and look at regulatory issues and regulatory implications. Chair, that's the gist of our presentation and the detailed submission, and we'll take questions. And thank you once again. Just let me also just in conclusion say that we are talking to the FSB about some of the recommendations we have made. It's unfortunate that diaries could not be coordinated and Audrey, our consultant, only managed to meet representatives of the FSB yesterday evening. And I think that some of the issues we've raised, they're not all of them, and not totally, but some of the issues we've raised, yeah, I think we would be able to pick up with the FSB after hearing that, but I've knocked them on the head. Thank you, Chair.
Thanks. Yes, we really encourage that because it helps with engagement. Okay, can I then request that the principal officer of the association come forward? And I trust that your presentation has been set up for the so you can now actually take the presentation. Association is represented by the lady and the gentleman, by Mr. Anna Marie and Mr. Tony Lima. Welcome. Can you put your mic on? And whilst Mr. Fuzun is doing this, I don't see your hard copies of it. If it's not there, we can just proceed if you have hard copies. And, can you put your mic on?
Is it better like this? Thank you so much. Thank you, Chairperson. I think let's proceed. I've just sent it through yesterday. My apologies if it's not here, but let's go. We did circulate our proposal, so what I'm going to do is just basically zoom in straight to the issues at hand, and thank you very much for this opportunity to make the presentation. I wanted to start with the role of the registrar and how we as the principal officers perceive this to play out in terms of what we see before us. I will start with what we all want to achieve, because I think because I think once we understand how we perceive the role of the registrar and the role of the Board of Trustees, it will be clear to you how we think this should be drafted. Now, we see the role of the registrar as the one that needs to supervise and regulate the rattan industry and not to interfere with the powers of the Board of Trustees. And to appoint principal officers that is fit and proper. Principal officers are not employed by the registrar, and they are not functionaries of the FSB. So our main concern here is that the registrar now assumes the position of making that appointment. If the registrar assumes the responsibility for the appointment and the termination of the services of the PO in the way the bill is suggesting, it would be easy for the Board of Trustees to shift the responsibility and blame to the registrar should disputes and claims arise subsequent to the appointment of the PO by the registrar. The registrar would have an added responsibility to constantly monitor and the Board of Trustees' conduct in the recruitment selection of the POs, which is not core to the functions of the registrar. The role of the Board of Trustees, on the other hand, is to direct, control, and manage the business of the fund in accordance with its rules and all the applicable laws. So the board is ultimately responsible for the recruitment, selection, and appointment on such terms as it may agree, and the performance management as well as the termination of the services of the PO. So the Board of Trustees is in the best position to effect the appointment in line with the specific needs and objectives of the fund. So if we then look at the proposal on the role of the registrar, the POA is of the opinion that the registrar should confine himself to the prescribed supervisory role, and that he could not do so by legislating on the criteria required for POs to be fit and proper, and by compelling funds to notify him of such appointments. So what we are basically saying is that the registrar should confirm the appointment, can vary the appointment, or can cancel the appointment. It's basically exactly what he is doing at present. So will the amendment then achieve its goal? So what should the role of the registrar then be? We say we will look at the process. He should look at the process. He should legislate for the fit and proper criteria. He should compel funds to notify the appointments. He should confirm, review, and cancel. And he should indicate the process to be followed if there are disputes in relation to objections. And then he should also develop the format for that submission. So let me then get into the actual recommendation per paragraph as set out in the amendment bill. Paragraph 3, and I'm now looking at subparagraph 4.3. Basically, we say that we agree with paragraph 4.3. There are certain gaps. We assume that there will be formats prescribed in how the submission must be made to the registrar on the notification, and we recommend that the registrar consult with the industry or with principal officers on drafting the minimum requirements. When we look at paragraph 4, we also agree with that, that nobody should have an opportunity to opt out of being confirmed as fit and proper. We also say that the power to terminate at this point in time, or as the draft wants it, is with the registrar, and the power to terminate should actually be with the Board of Trustees. The registrar should not have the power to hire and fire because he is not there at the grassroots level where the appointments are taking place and where the actual recruitment and selection is happening. And the Board of Trustees should continue to have that power to do that. When we look at recommendation 4, 5, A, and B, we agree with that recommendation, but with reservations. We say that what happens at this point in time, or as the bill wants it to do, is that the registrar will, once he objects to an appointment, instruct that the principal officer must be terminated, his employment must be terminated within 14 days after that. There is no time period mentioned for the registrar to respond to the submission, and there's also no procedure set out in the legislation at this point or in the bill to say what the appeal process will be, although it is assumed that such processes will be in place. There's no provision in the status of what will happen with the principal officer once such an objection is there. And will the fund, no provision on the status of the principal officer while the fund awaits final determination of the appeal. So the fund will be without a principal officer for some time, and it will be in limbo. So what we recommend is that the registrar should respond to submissions to confirm, vary, or cancel appointments, that there should be an appeal process put in place, and that there should be certain time periods linked to the appeal process, and should principal officers or the board funds show good cause, if they cannot meet that deadline, that the process can continue. Then when we look at paragraphs 4, 5, C, we will follow a two-prong approach in this, general views, and then we will have specific views as per the sub-paragraph. If you look at the general views, we support the notion of fit and proper criteria, although with some reservation. If you look at generally at the literature, there are basically three broad categories of fit and proper: good category, character, competence and capability, personal financial soundness. Now, if you look at the gaps in relation to that, you'll see that the criteria that is presented is very limited, and you might not find all the aspects or elements of good character, competence and capability, and personal soundness in there. There's no logic in the flow of the presentation of grouping the various categories together. So you will find, in the way that it's drafted, you will find competence issues, and then you will find capabilities issues, and it's just very confusing. There's also, it's very open to subjective interpretation. The burden of proof in many of those provisions are not with courts or competent authorities, but what the registrar perceives, if he has reason to believe. If there is a suspicion, things can happen, and that is problematic. So it can open up for many, many challenges. We also looked at it and say it is ultimately, it is confusing who will ultimately bear the responsibility for the appointment. Presently, it says that the registrar will make the appointment, but it's the Board of Trustees that's doing recruitment and selection. So if there is a dispute, it will be easy to shift the blame from pillar to point. It will be easy for boards of trustees just to say, it's not my problem, the registrar is not appointing you. The registrar will say, no, but board of trustees, you've taken that decision to appoint this person. So in the case of dispute, where will the principal officer ultimately go to? The registrar might find himself lost in fighting objections and appeals, and we feel that that is actually not core to what he is supposed to do. It is also not clear how the law will deal with the various appeals. So what we suggest is an entire redraft of section of 5C in line with our submission in terms of Annexure A, and I will deal with that shortly. We also feel that there are many principal officers that need to go through this process. If there's about 13,000 funds, you know, there might be not so many principal officers, but it's going to be quite a huge task to get them all declared or confirmed as fit and proper. So there should be, and there's no mention of a window period to meet that specific criteria. How are we going to do that particular process? So there should be transitional arrangements as well. And then we feel that the registrar should also have an exemption provision in that if there are some exceptional circumstances where a PO cannot meet this criteria, that he has the discretion to say, I'm not going to confirm or I vary your appointment. So when you look at 5C1 specifically, we agree with similar proposals. Where we say competence and judgment should be included, but we want to point out not all principal officers presently might have formal qualifications. They are there because they work for the fund for 15 to 20 years and they've been doing this for a long time. So there should be transitional arrangements to allow that to continue. If you then go further and you talk about the diligence, it's 4.5C2. We feel that there should be inclusions around diligence and it's part of competence, but there's no assessment criteria involved. It's based on very subjective prescience, and it's almost impossible to determine the future conduct of a principal officer. If we go to 4.5C4AA2DD, we say, yes, it could also be there, but former principal officers have never been subjected to any investigations or disciplinary actions, and it will be very difficult to actually determine whether they are fit and proper if we go back and try to implement this. Enforcement will also be problematic, and again, the role of the competent court has not been explained. There is no mention how outstanding convictions will be dealt with. And none of the actions of principal officers alone can really result in a fund not being meeting its obligations. So when we look at ESG again, and that is in relation to the business issues, we feel that the powers are extremely wide, and again the fear for the subjectivity that that is in there. So generally speaking, assessment criteria that is absent. The registrar will get involved in all sorts of unrelated investigations to try and find out whether there are issues that has not been declared. There's also a cost implication. Who will take responsibility for payment of these investigations? And it's quite possible that people with malicious intent might just drop something and say, registrar, have you heard? And the registrar will have to go and make that investigation. So therefore, again, the issue of competent courts and authorities is very important. When we look at D, it is the investigation part where the registrar says that he can appoint anybody to assist with investigations. There's no indication who will pay for that investigation. The fund and the PO will the fund and the PO have a say in that appointment? They might feel that the people that will investigate are not fair or perceived to be fair. And we recommend that there is already an advisory committee, a vice advisory committee in place that can assist the registrar with fit and proper assessments. And then in terms of the inclusion of whistleblowing provisions, that is six, I think when we read the two provisions, first it was very confusing. We interpreted it in three ways. First, we thought that the paragraph A dealt with the appeal process in terms of 5B. Then later, after clarifications, we've realized, okay, maybe it deals with the whistleblowing issue. But it wasn't well drafted, and it was very confusing. And I think what we say here is it's not clear how the enforcement will take place. It's not clear how principal officers will be protected if they do blow the whistle. It is not clear what will happen to the principal officer if he or she failed to report anything and just left the fund with, you know, once they terminated their services. And it is felt that maybe we defer this particular amendment until such time that we had an opportunity to properly consult on that. In terms of the good character, the three issues that we said, fairness, good character, honesty, integrity, fairness, and interpretation, that's our annexure. We feel that that is something that can only be demonstrated over time. Issues that can be included to demonstrate that is no conviction of disciplinary and criminal offences, dishonesty, fraud, or criminal crime, subject to adverse findings in civil courts. If you've been suspended or disqualified from professional bodies, regulators, or licences revoked, your business has been placed under curatorship of liquidation, when you've not been truthful and fair in the dealings with your customers, auditors, and so forth, if that can be proved, and you demonstrate a willingness to comply to legislation and so forth, that should be, you know, a much fairer and more objective way to deal with that. In terms of competence and capability, you can demonstrate competence and ability to understand the technical requirements and operations of the business and the funds, their inherent risk, as well as the management processes. And that can be done in three ways: through qualifications, experience, and knowledge, and whether you've been disciplined by any professional body, the regulator, or any authorities, and if you've been asked to resign from a position of trust. Because we work with principal officers that might not have all of that, it can be an or situation. And obviously financial soundness, whether it's been liquidated. I think that wraps up my presentation. Sorry that, you know, there was this misunderstanding with not having the visuals available. But basically, to conclude, there are three things that we say here, is that we do support fit and proper criteria for principal officers. What we disagree with is that the registrar should have the authority to hire and fire. That should still reside with the board, and we feel that the issue around whistleblowing should be deferred. Thank you.
And the next presentation, the Law Officers Association. We also have a copy of a hard copy of the Law Officers Association. Why don't you consider to us, but at least from the Law Officers Association, we have Sana Rosenberg, who is the Deputy Executive Legal and Policy. I see there are three of them. The other one is Sagi Narasan, convener of the Legal Committee. Okay. And then the other one is Mr. Roger Stevenson, welcome, convener of the Retirement Funds Committee, legal advisor from Old Mutual. Welcome, the floor is yours.
Okay. We seem to be right on time, so I hope I can stick to the schedule. We've also given quite a lengthy written submission, and I hope this presentation will highlight the key points in that. We are going to deal with the bill in a slightly different order with the Pension Funds Act at the end. The tabled version also had a few different, some amendments, and that's dealt with a few of our written comments, so we haven't included those. But there was also, I must say, a short time to deal with this bill. It's got quite a few amendments and provisions, and I hope we've been able to pick up the key points. Okay, looking first at the amendments to the FSB Act. We're looking here at the appeal provisions. The definition of decision maker seems to include the phase onboard. And Section 26, which deals with the appeal process against the decision of a decision maker, differs from the appeal process under the FAS Act, because here the appeal is automatic. Need to appeal is automatic, whereas under the FAS Act it's at discretion. So we think those should be aligned and the FAS Act should be amended. Then the section also says that an appeal must be lodged within 30 days of the person becoming aware of a decision. Here, a person also needs to be aware of the reasons for the decision, so we suggested that those words be added in that section. I haven't included the point, but we pick it up later on under the Enforcement Committee proceedings as well, that the suspension of the decision, or the execution of the decision, is not suspended pending an appeal, which is the normal process. And again, we think that this should be the case. So that section regarding the decision of the appeal of the decision maker should be suspended pending an appeal. Okay, then we're moving on to the Financial Institutions Protection of Funds Act, which deals with the details around the Enforcement Committee. Again, we wish to express our support for the principle around setting up an enforcement committee, but we have some concerns around the framework. The consideration must be that the panel must be independent and impartial, and we think that the way the panel is constituted does satisfy this requirement. The right to legal representation, it says that the chairperson may allow legal representation. We say that the legal representation should be allowed because of the gravity of the penalties as well as the reputational damage that can be incurred. Then the burden of proof, we assume it's on a balance of probabilities, but this seems to be a mismatch between that burden of proof and the type of sanctions which equate to criminal sanctions. So we question whether the burden of proof is appropriate. And on the penalties that can be imposed, there's no maximum. I seem to recall in a previous bill that the state law advisor says there should be a maximum penalty stipulated in all cases. And I mean, we think this should be the case because there can't be an open discretion and people need to know what the law is. Then moving on to Section 64. When the briefing on the bill, it was explained that the Enforcement Committee is complementary to the criminal system. And we question why, if a criminal charge is laid, it means that no enforcement action can be taken. And then there's also the cost of the panel and expenses incurred by the applicant can be awarded against the respondent. We think this is a bit harsh. Under normal sort of criminal or civil proceedings, a legal cost award can be made, but not for the entire proceedings. Then again, the appeal proceedings are not suspended. This goes against the legal principles. And also, practically, if a person has to pay a compensatory award, then how are they going to recover it at a later stage? So we are submitting that they should be suspended unless the court decides otherwise, on good caution. Okay, then moving on to the FAS Act. Sort of slightly different points, but also around inspections and on-site visits to the banking association. On who can conduct an on-site visit, We think that the words "any suitable person" need to be defined more clearly. And also, the registrar should have reasonable grounds to suspect non-compliance before such a visit takes place. Then access should only be to documents relative to the reasons for the inspection or investigation. So again, it shouldn't be completely open. And then, especially Section 4.6, I mean, it doesn't say that the provider or representative needs to be given notice or given a copy of the report before the registrar makes their decision. And so the registrar is given completely unfettered discretion without any guidelines or limitations. And, I mean, they could basically stop the provider or representative from conducting any business. Then Section 7.3, we support the aim here to ensure that an FSP only does business with another licensed FSP, but I've given suggested wording to make the section clearer as it is open to interpretation. We've also said that it should be extended to product providers who are not FSPs. There are some product providers who don't give any advice or intermediary services. The insurers already have this requirement in the policyholder protection rules to the Long-Term Insurance Act, and we think it should be extended across the financial services. It appears also from the wording in the section that the FSP is required to check that the FSP they're doing business with is licensed in the correct product category. If this is the case, we question why this is necessary. Once you know that the person is licensed, they fall within the framework, and it seems duplication of effort to have to check the product categories. If this is indeed the requirement, then it will require extensive systems work, and some time is needed. We've said at least a year to 18 months. Then the key individual and the requirement to notify of other company changes other than the key individual. So, for example, if a director of a company is appointed, but they're not a key individual. We're not sure why this is necessary because the key individual deals with the overseeing the provision of the financial services. And the other directors are already regulated under the Companies Act. So, again, it seems overkill. Then moving on to debarment. Section 14 says that basically they extend the grounds for debarment to say that any contravention of FAS is grounds for debarment. And we say that this is too wide. I mean, there might be really administrative sections of the Act and basically not rendering the person not fit and proper, but you would have to debar the person because of this wording. So we suggest that serious non-compliance under the Act should be dealt with by expanding the fit and proper requirements. Section 14A, again, there's similar wording around any contravention of the Act. So we repeat our comments on that wording. And this allows the registrar to also debar, which we welcome because there was a gap where the representatives resign and debarment proceedings can't be taken by the FSP or the FSP doesn't take the appropriate debarment action. And then finally, Section 33A, again, we say that it should specify the maximum amount of any punitive penalty. Okay, that deals with all the sections except for the Pension Funds Act, where we have made some detailed comments through the Institute of Retirement Funds on some of the amendments, but we will just be focusing on Section 37D, which deals with the treatment of the pension interest on divorce. And I'm going to hand over to Rod. Thanks.
Thank you. Section 37D of the Pension Fund Act was amended last year to provide for the clean break principle, and it became effective from 13 September 2007. The bill now provides for the clean break principle to apply to pre-13 September 2007 divorce awards, and also reformulate some of the processes involved in both pre- and post-13 September 2007 cases. We need to emphasize that we support the clean break principle, but we have a number of implications and perhaps unintended effects to raise with you today. Among the wording and process issues, perhaps just briefly to advert to those, we need to highlight that there's a circularity in some of the provisions for the timing of deductions from the members' benefits, deductions of the awards, and this could lead to, in fact, unenforceability of the provision, and we suggest that the deductions be implemented on the receipt of the election from the non-member spouse. Secondly, it's clear, it appears from the wording that neither the member nor the spouse will for a period benefit from the fund interest earnings, and that clearly couldn't have been the intention, and that needs to be addressed in the drafting. There are also provisions that require the fund to make and or to request the non-member spouse to make an election. Now, this is practically a hurdle because most funds do not have the details of non-member spouses, and this will impose quite a burden. And we suggest that the request for an election should be dependent on receipt of the contact details of the non-member spouse. We also note in passing that there are problems arising from the definition of pension interest in the Divorce Act, which need to be addressed and probably cannot be addressed simply through the Pension Funds Act. In particular, for instance, it would appear that the divorce awards against preservation funds will lead to a mere nil pension interest, and therefore are effectively inapplicable to preservation funds, and this can only be amended by some change to the Divorce Act definition. The effect on vested rights of members is a concern in that in the divorce process, it deals with the division of matrimonial patrimonial property, which includes pension benefits. And typically, in pre-13 September 2000 cases, the parties involved would have, in all likelihood, taken into account the fact that the non-member's share of the pension interest would only have been paid out to him at some future date, or him or her at some future date. And although they may not have known with certainty when the date would have been, they would have made reasonable assumptions, and they would have provided for potentially some sort of growth to compensate the non-member spouse for the fact that there were no interest earnings. This would have been made part of the agreement, and court orders would have taken this into account. In those circumstances, the new provision to make it accessible to the non-member spouse at 13 September alters these arrangements and without making compensatory provision for the member spouse. And we feel that possibly a way to consider a way of ameliorating this potentially negative impact is to provide for an approach, say, to the High Court to allow the member spouse to show that it would be inequitable for the retrospective application to his, her, or her particular case. And this might ameliorate some of the negative implication of this process. There are also certain effects on the funds themselves of this process. Typically, funds take long-term investment strategies to meet their commitments over time. And if large numbers of non-member spouses can now access at almost the same their divorce awards, there will be a run on the funds or the assets of the funds. And this could potentially have quite a damaging effect depending on the number of awards that exist under that fund. So huge unanticipated sums might have to be paid out. And in addition to that, expenses will be incurred that were not anticipated in the systems that have been developed for that fund. So there will be a leakage, a considerable leakage, and there will be considerable expenses involved for the funds. But looking at the effect particularly on the interests of the non-member spouse, again, we have to say that we support the aim of the clean break principle. As we understand it, the problem of the old dispensation was primarily that the non-member spouse did not get interest earnings on the award. So this was the primary, as we see it, the primary fault of the old system. But now it's proposed that the non-member spouse can get immediate access to cash and not use the money for retirement funding. And as indicated, this is likely to lead to, therefore, a substantial leakage in retirement provision from these funds. We can't estimate exactly what this leakage is likely to be. We don't have exact figures, although there's anecdotal evidence of some funds having very large numbers of divorce awards. One can play with figures based on percentages of current membership and average awards, and one could easily, by that means, arrive at figures like 30 billion rand or more, which is a very substantial potential leakage. Our proposal, therefore, is that the clean break be accepted, but that instead of allowing access to the cash, that the award be preserved in the originating fund and that pension interest be added to that award for the non-member spouse. And our view is that this proposal would address both the leakage, it would address the growth problem for the non-member spouse, and it would address the potential administration issues for funds. Thank you. That's our presentation.
Thanks, LOA. We've had the three submissions. You can stay right there. Stay right there because we are now going to take a discussion on all three submissions. Members, we've had the Banking Association, we've had the Principal Officers Association and the Life Officers Association. It's now time for a discussion. Questions, comments? Members? Mr. Mlata, Dr. George, Mr. Mbuni, Mr. Mare, in that order. Mr. Mlata.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I must say I'm attesting to some of the views of the Banking Association. In terms of when the license is withdrawn, that the banking supervision division of the Reserve Bank should be notified. But I'm sympathetic to you for other reasons, not the same reasons that you have. For me, I understand perfectly what you are trying to say, because if, for instance, if Standard Bank, let me just use Standard Bank, they've got a division that offers financial advice and so forth, or even managing pensions, and their license is withdrawn, that puts the credibility of the bank at stake. That becomes a problem. For me, it can cause other problems. But I would say, where I differ with you is to say that then the banking supervision should be alerted, because maybe they're the lead regulator or whatever. But because what we need to understand in this case, that the license is confined to pensions or whatever, pensions, that are financial, it's not about banking. So the, what the bank is, what my own understanding is that what the FSB will be withdrawing is not a, a banking license. It's a license for a financial service provider. So for me, that shouldn't be a problem. I think for me, the problem is how the regulators talk to each other to ensure that, you know, one, it's possible that that might, for me, hence I'm talking about other reasons, it's possible that the time you withdraw that license, it might be signaling other serious issues relating to the banking side of that institution. And if you withdraw the license of and not know what's happening, you don't have a consolidated approach to the risk management of that industry. For me, that's the problem. On the issue of fit and proper, still I disagree with you a bit, because for my own understanding is that the fit and proper requirement here is for a financial service provider or a fund manager, but it's not for a banking license. So my understanding is that the financial service board wouldn't be talking about the fit and proper requirement for the whole bank. It'd be talking about specifically for financial service provider or fund manager purposes. The other issue which I'd want to deal with, it's the issue from the other institution called the Principal Officers Association. You keep on making the statement that the FSB would be making appointments for principal officers. I can't find it in the legislation, in the bill. Because what I see in the bill is that the FSB can only object. You keep on referring to 5C. So can I use 5C? 5C for me, 5C, it says the register may, for purposes of assessing if a principal officer is not or is no longer a fit and proper person in accordance with paragraph A, have regard to. It doesn't say that anywhere in this section that the register will be responsible for the appointment of principal officers. I can't find it. Maybe you have to assist me and direct me to that one. My last question, Chair, is to the LOA. I'm sorry, Chair, this document will read them at night when everybody's asleep, so we might not be quite sure at times. The LOA is saying, you know, that there must be reasonable grounds for, registrar should have reasonable grounds to suspect non-compliance before undertaking inspection and on-site visits. I have a problem with that, because for me, a normal regulator would conduct on-site visits and inspections, even if there's no problem. I think that is in the nature of a regulator. And it also arises from our hearings from FIC. We talk as if we have got a very intrusive regulator who is going to violate people's rights, whatever. But the international norm is that every regulator is given these powers. And the World Bank has done a study, and a regulator who doesn't have these powers, for me, if I had to go into South Africa and the regulator doesn't have this power, I wouldn't want to invest or form a bank there, because it's just posing major problems. You know, I want a strong regulator who doesn't violate people's rights, but we have the powers to go and investigate, go and inspect, but to say that they must have a reasonable ground to do so, it violates my own understanding, really, of the powers of regulators internationally. Dr. George?
Thank you, Chair. For the Banking Association, you mentioned that the scope of inspections and visits could be too wide. My question would just be, for the banking sector, what is the potential impact if inspections are, in fact, too wide and visits are too wide? And then for the Principal Officers Association is, how is the performance of principal officers currently evaluated, and what is the current criteria for appointments? Thanks, Chair.
Okay. Can I request that the Principal Officers Association take their seat there, because you know, they're sitting behind members, and the time is given to see the face of the member when he's asking a question, so that your response also
But also when you respond, I think members also want to see your face. Okay. Because at least depending on the situation, it's not basic. Okay.
Thanks, Chair. I have two questions for the Banking Association on the citizen proper. It's on the on your paragraph 231, romantic afraid that personal character qualities of honesty and integrity. In that paragraph, you're saying that it will be onerous. I just want to find out how is the personal character the onerous to the Banking Association or to any financial institution. And secondly, that you said you don't see non-banking institutions posing a threat or a risk when admitted into the payment system. But what risk would you foresee or do you think might be posed by these non-banking institutions? On the personal officers, Chairperson, I think my question has been already asked by Mr. Mlatu, because you look through the bill, you don't see where the registrar shall say they are. But as you said, there are about 13,000 funds. I don't see a registrar now monitoring 13,000 people appointing and firing. And then on the Law Officers Association, on page 2 of your presentation, of the register, the SIP document, 7.2, you think that it could have an effect of funds or investment strategies, as you said, there might be a leakage of pensions for both spouses. And you're saying that it will impose a costly administrative burden on pensions. I just you can just give an indicative figure when you say it will be costly. I'm talking of thousands, I'm talking of millions. And then if the spouses, they get their money, now it's not actually 50% of the people that are going to divorce in your fund. It might be perhaps 2-3%. Now, how is that pose a risk to the fund? Are you acting in the interest of the beneficiaries or in the interest of the fund or your interest? Because I think if more people get their money, then you will lose with the other fund. I just want to find out where your interest lies.
Thank you, Chair. Just one comment or question to the banking industry. So you've mentioned quite a few times that it seems like there's a creeping into each other's domain in terms of the different regulators. Obviously, what we require, as Mr. Mlatu has said, that we need effective regulators, but certainly we don't want to be part to see that, you know, there's duplications. What is your suggestion? Do we need a re-evaluation of all regulations of applicable to banks, or how do we need to approach, in your view, that specific challenge?
Thank you,
Chair.
Can we then take responses perhaps in the same order as the presentations were made? Let's take the other question. Sorry.
Thank you, Chair. Just a small one to the LOA. The question of appeal. And you have said that you feel that the decision should be suspended, the decision of decision maker. Mm-hmm. But there is a provision here that one could make a submission to the chairperson or deputy chairperson of the appeal board. Because the nature of the offence might be so that, the appeal could take a long time. And the nature of the offence might be so that one could not allow the translation to continue. I just want your views on that, because there is a provision which allows you to make a submission to the chairperson.
Okay, let's take responses, starting with the banking.
I'm going to start, and I'm going to ask my colleagues just to add on some of the specifics. On the whole issue about licensing and afraid that you agree that there should be some, that the licenses that could be withdrawn are for the FSP function of the bank and not the entire, it's not the banking license. One appreciates that, but the reputational impact on a bank, I mean, people outside that bank don't separate the FSP function from the rest of the bank. And I think that all we are appealing for is for regulators to, and I'm not saying they don't have, they don't do this, but we'd like to see a bit more of this, for regulators to understand the impact of particular types of regulation on particular types of businesses. You know, a bank is a specific type of business that places significant onus on reputation. And we've seen what happens when bank's reputation goes down or is perceived to have gone down. So I think that while regulators can separate their areas of regulation, it's very difficult in a banking business to say, well, we're putting FSP into this box, and we're putting the rest of the business into the other box. So I think that we just need to recognize that, and the regulators need to interact with each other to see how we mitigate that. Okay. On the foot and proper issue again, Mr. Malhotra makes the point that this piece of legislation talks about foot and proper related to the FSP area, not the entire banking business. Now, I think our appeal would be that if the banking regulations, which are the primary regulation for banks, have foot and proper requirements for the business of banks, from where I sit, now it might be more complicated if I'm a regulator, but from where I sit, I would say, as a phase regulator, let me sit down with a banking regulator and say, look, can we do anything in the Banks Act around the foot and proper requirements to actually accommodate what we want to achieve here? So that I then, as a banker, report to the registrar of banks under the Banks Act on all my foot and proper requirements to satisfy FSP issues, to satisfy FICA issues, or whatever else it might be. The more we have a situation, let's say, okay, for the entire banking business on foot and proper issues, report to the registrar of banks. For FSP issues on foot and proper issues, report to the phase regulator. For if there are foot and proper requirements under credit provision, report to the national credit regulator. And all of those reporting requirements need system adjustments, need a whole lot of administrative issues behind it. It just becomes untenable. And so all we're saying is that we need to find some mechanism to coordinate the efforts. We need to find some mechanism where if there's a myriad of reporting requirements, can we report into a single register and can those be parceled out to different regulators and so on. I think we need to open that discussion. On the other question related to foot and proper personal character qualities of honesty and integrity, we are not for one moment saying that we should not have people with those qualities. But those qualities are very often subjective qualities. I can sit here and say I have very good qualities of honesty and respect and so on, and then turn around and tell Ozzy something that totally militates against that. And all we're saying is that for subjective qualities like that, if you want to actually measure that, then have some criteria against which to measure. Otherwise, the meaning of honesty to me would be very different to the meaning of honesty to you. And we're saying that for subjective qualities like that, if you want to actually measure subjective qualities like that, have some sort of criteria. On the impact of requested details being too wide, I'm going to ask either Nikki or Audrey to deal with that. On non-bank risk, I'm going to ask Art to deal with that, and I'll add if I need to. The regulatory duplication, the crossing over into other regulations, what to do about it. You know, I
sometimes, and Chair, please forgive me, because sometimes I get a bit frustrated. Sometimes I get the impression that regulators take the view at times that I am responsible for regulating a particular area of activity, and therefore I've got to do the best I can under that, which is great. But quite honestly, I don't need to worry about what other regulators are doing and what those regulators demand of these institutions. Now, I think that's a problem. And a way forward on this issue would at least be, again, from where I sit and maybe from a regulator's point of view, it might be more difficult. But I think that somebody like National Treasury maybe should be taking the lead in saying, let's go through a process where we pull together the different regulators. We pull together associations representing different parts of the financial industry. And we begin asking, where do we want to take this industry in the next 10 to 15 years? What role should this industry be playing in the ongoing socio-economic transformation in this country? Let's have a discussion around that. Let's see if we can get our minds together on that, and then ask, if that's what we want to achieve, how should this industry be regulated? Now, that might lead to a single regulator. It might lead to a whole range of things. I don't know. I'm not going there. That might even lead to no regulation.
No. What you said earlier was adequate.
Yeah. Okay. You can expunge that from the records. Yeah. But I think that we need that sort of a discussion. And I would think that National Treasury is ideally suited to do that. If I could ask colleagues to add.
Just very briefly, Mr. Chair, just on the issue of the licenses, Mr. Malota, surely there is a FIRST license. We recognize that. Surely there is a banking license. But let's take ABSA for example, and sorry to use ABSA. You know, within a bank or an FSP, you have numerous licenses. Now, ABSA is a good example because ABSA Bank Limited, which is also the banking license holder, is a financial service provider. It holds a FIRST license. So ABSA Brokers, for instance, doesn't hold a banking license. They just have a FIRST license. What are we saying? We're not saying that if APSA, Pty Limited, or APSA Brokers transgress FIRST, that the FIRST registrar mustn't pull the license. That's not what we're saying. We're saying that if the financial service provider, the FSP, is regulated by another regulatory authority, and which is your primary regulator, in our case, the banking regulator, and the financial and the FIRST regulator finds reason to want to either suspend or withdraw that FIRST license. Before you do that, please speak to the other financial regulator. We're not saying that our guys can never transgress FIRST. We're saying if that happens, by all means, FIRST go ahead with your action in time to come, but please consult with our primary regulator because there will be issues, there will be risk issues. And I think you mentioned the point about an integrated risk approach, which is part of CASA's, should be part of CASA's answer to the last question about what should be done in terms of overall regulation. I think if financial regulation also adopt the same risk approach, maybe, to the extent that it's possible, then with regard to fit and proper, let us just understand what the amendments are saying. The amendments are saying, as it is now, that the financial service provider is responsible for the appointment of people. Those people must be fit and proper, very well. Financial service provider is responsible for ensuring that those people carry out their functions, very well. Now the amendments come and say, and we give the power to the registrar to, at some stage, when he is convinced of certain things, declare that person not fit and proper. Okay, now how we bring that into the banking with regard to trustees and directors, etc., how we bring that into our banking environment, we're saying that in order to get a banking license, we go back to ABSA, in order to get a banking license for ABSA, there had to be a form with a lot of declarations and the banking regulator had to be satisfied that the directors of the APSA license are fit and proper. Right. What we're saying is, if the very same APSA FICE license, or the very same APSA trustee or director is deemed by the FICE registrar not to be fit and proper, after he's been approved by the banking registrar, just talk to each other. We're not saying that FICE must be subjected to the same talk.
You don't belabor this one. I think you've made your point.
You think repeatedly?
Yeah. I mean, in the interest of time, I would actually want, because I want to give the others also an opportunity to read it. Those that have not been judged. Yeah.
Thank you very much. Just in terms of the question, what risks do non-banks potentially bring into the payment system? Banks are required to filter their customers which they bring into the payment system. Potentially the risk is there that some of these non-banks coming to the payment system will not be required to filter their customers, and that is the risk that we've identified as a major concern.
Mr. Chair, I just want to take up the issue of that which relates to the question of the on-site visit and the powers being too wide. What is proposed is that the registrar may make known any detail regarding the on-site visit or inspection. I think the intention is the details relate to that which the purpose for which an inquiry is called for. So maybe it just requires a bit of cleansing or cleaning up in terms of terminology of any details for the purpose for which the inquiry was called. So the detail is not anything. It's specifically you came here for this purpose, so you're rectifying that purpose. So that's what is the issue of being too wide. Thank you.
But I think that was also discussed at the initial briefing, I would imagine. It's being accommodated. But also I would imagine that in the process of the on site visit, some evidence that reveals another even if you had gone in for something else, but you might pick up something which is another breach of legislation. I mean, does that then mean that the regulator must not actually, pursue that one? But that's also another matter we'll continue to discuss that. But I would imagine restricting whoever is doing the inspection to, specifically what he has gone in for is another subject for discussion, because as we go on, and that person picks up something that that might be a breach of any other thing, which might even be more serious than what you had gone there for. Would you then say no, but this is not what I had come in for? We'll come back. I don't know. But other responses. Principal officers. Yeah. I said in the same order.
Thank you, Chairperson. We agree that we might have been wrong in the way that we've interpreted that, but we've led to believe, if you read 5B, that the decision of that appointment is ultimately in the hands of the registrar. He has to confirm that. And once he's done so and he objects, there is a direct instruction. You have to terminate the appointment within 14 days. Now, the minute that the registrar gives an instruction to terminate, he actually also has the decision to appoint. And that is how we have interpreted that. So maybe if there is just an amendment to say, I do not agree or I object to this, but you don't get that instruction to terminate, and once the objection is put before the Board of Trustees, they can then react to that to either rectify it and make sure that fit and proper criteria is met, then I assume that would be fine. The issue here is the minute that the registrar says terminate, he actually appoints as well. You can't have it in both places. The issue on assessment, obviously the discretion on how performance is assessed lies with the Board of Trustees. There is no formal process, although BF 130 now says that there should be a process in place. We see that from our experience that is happening within the industry, that performance assessments are being taken up and implemented in funds, but it's the sole discretion of the funds how they want to go about performance appraisals within of the principal officers.
Hello.
Thanks, Chair. I'm just going to start off with one question and then hand over to my colleagues. Mr. Singh's question about the appeal process, I take the point that there may be instances where there's a serious transgression that needs to be sort of put in, halted immediately, not wait until the appeal process is complete. But we think that the test should be turned around. I mean, it shouldn't be that they should not be suspended in all cases. There should be that it should be suspended unless there's good reason why it shouldn't be suspended. I don't know if my colleague Sagi wants to add to that, and he'll also deal with the reasonable grounds question, and Rod will deal with the pension funds.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll just limit myself to the reasonable grounds question. Of course we support an effective regulator. Our concern is that the efficacy spoken about is based on a subjective discretion. We believe that a subjective discretion has to be mediated by the principle of proportionality. And if one mates efficacy with proportionality, the child that is born is reasonableness, and that's the basis of our submission.
So we've always accused the financial services board of always reacting, and they've never been tried. When the matter is, you know, before, I mean, when it's already in the media, and so much damage has happened, and we've been accusing them. I mean, why is it that you are not proactive in some of these things? And I would imagine at the end of the day, that's where we want to go. And like Mr. Mlotha indicated, that we want a regulator that is, effective, and that goes out there, not only be called upon when something has happened. The
other one related to costs and risks associated with the run on divorce awards pre 13 September 2007 cases. It's very difficult, in fact, to come up with any definite cost effect, because these are typically related to the funds in question and the administration systems in question, which differ. The dealing with the post 13 September 2007 cases, even those, are going to require systems adjustments and therefore increasing costs. But those are relatively infrequent and can be anticipated in the future. The fact is that the pre 13 September 2007 cases are in some cases number thousands upon thousands in large funds, and there will be a demand over a short, possibly 3-month period. That's the potential. And therefore, they will not be able to be dealt with in terms of the standard electronic systems that are currently operating, and there will have to be manual interventions, which are costly. If one thinks, for instance, one can put theoretical numbers. If one assumes that a fund has 50,000 divorce awards pre 13 September, and they all approach within a 3-month period, and you put a fixed cost to each one, one already sees that that is likely to exceed many millions of rand additional cost. But as I say, that will differ from fund to fund. The draw on the investments will also have their costs, of course, but the important thing is there that there will be a sudden leakage and a sudden liquidity need in the fund. So assets will have to be realized to meet that sudden demand, and as I indicated, there too scenarios can be played with. It's very difficult to say what percentage in total of funds comprise pre-13 September divorce awards. But if one looks at the numbers of divorces over, say, the last decade, one gets an idea of a pretty large number. I think there have been suggestions that there are 35,000 at least divorces a year over the last decade. And one puts that against the number of members, one could get anything from 5 to 10% of members having a divorce award against their benefit. And that's a substantial number. You're talking about 3/4 to perhaps 1.5 million members across the industry. And therefore, the leakage is potentially very large in total. Obviously, as I say, this differs very markedly from fund to fund. There are some funds which will have many, there are some funds which will have very few and will be unaffected by this. But it's very difficult to put a specific cost. One can only at this stage play around with numbers, but they look significant from any perspective. Even with very low additional costing, we're talking about millions for even smallish numbers. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. Brings us to the end of this first hour. I actually wanted now to recommend that we break for tea so that members can then go down.
I asked what the current criteria for employment of political officers is. Thank you.
Okay, I see Mr. Mlodo's hand also. Was there a deadlock to your question?
It's something that I request National Treasury to note from the submission of the banking super association. I've lost track of it, but it's about the financial year. You know, because they are saying the bank, their own regulator is talking about a different financial year from that of, I think it's a serious matter that needs to be dictated.
Yeah, in fact, at the end of this session, what I would recommend we do is to ask National Treasury and the FSB if there are any areas that they would want to clarify why the president is still here. That's what we normally try and accommodate so that we are of the same understanding of issues. Don't give you and we think we are addressing the problem, and yet that is not what was meant by the presenter. We break for tea. Let's respond to Dr. George's question, and then we'll break for tea for 15 minutes and come back.
Currently, for principal officers, there are no formal criteria. There are not formal criteria, but the fund trustees do this election basically on the basis that they are subject to certain conditions and they are subject to certain criteria, like fit and proper person. And they will use the same type of criteria when they make an appointment for a principal officer. Right. They would be looking at whether a person has got the necessary competence, financial skills, etc., and they will make a decision accordingly. But basically, they sort of very much guided also by what is in PF1 City as regards the assessment of principal officers as to what does a principal officer need to comply with from a statutory point of view as set out in the Pension Funds Act.
One that Mr. Kovalyov says is maybe very subjective. Go ahead.
Chairperson, I'm so sorry. You know, sometimes you think about an answer just, you know, when you have a little bit more time. Will it be fine if I just make a final comment on the first issue about the termination? I think what is happening here is that the process is just the opposite way than it should happen. The registrar should not object to an appointment and terminate. What should happen is once the registrar has said no, I'm not confirming that. It is actually the board that needs to go back and say, I object to that, and then have to prove, you know, that indeed the registrar is wrong, because we do it just the other way around. So the onus at the end is with the registrar, you know, to confirm and to clarify and to have the burden of proof instead of the board. And, yeah, maybe that is just something that you can think about. Thank you.
You're opposed to giving the registrar powers to appoint. Now you're giving the registrar. okay, let's break for tea. 15 minutes, we'll be back here. It's got to be 11.
I could start on page 7 of the newly printed Gazette. They have the same problem as the FSB had on Wednesday, where they were referring to a different printed version. And that is paragraph 8 of the amendment, specifically referring with underneath the Pension Fund Act, and that's what we'd like to talk to specifically. Now, I know this matter has been in front of the House before, but we would like to just perhaps elaborate a little bit on the ACI's view on this issue, and I am aware that there are some intermediary associations present as well at the moment, both the FPI and the Financial Intermediary Association, FIA, also here, I think, with fairly similar views to ourselves. So I think we probably can talk for them as well in many instances. So really, today, what we'd just like to make the point is that we completely and utterly agree with the Treasury and with Financial Services Board about the issue of no payment being made on a transfer between RA funds. We completely agree with the principle. It's right that somebody should not get an additional fee for that. And in fact, we agree with them that in the cases where upfront commission was paid, that no further upfront commission could be made on the new money as well. In other words, what we're saying is absolutely, when we talk about commissions, yes, if the client has already made the payments, there's no reason for them to make further payments on money that they've already put into an RA. But where we think the confusion is in the way that it's worded in this is that we think it starts to influence an area of a different kind of fee, and that's the whole area where a payment is made by the client to the intermediary for ongoing advice on the portfolio. And I'm going to elaborate a little bit further around those differences. It really comes down to the definition of commission and fees, and it's quite interesting if you go to the Long-Term Insurance Act, which this section refers to, there is really no clear definition of the differences between commission and fees within the long-term industry. But within the way that the industry has developed, the financial services industry has developed in South Africa, there are different terminologies applied in the different areas. And I'd like to talk specifically about the regulated environment, which is what the long-term insurers operate under, and the unregulated environment, which is where collective investment schemes operate. Now, when this was before the House last time, there was a big issue about the requirement to make sure that no churning of policies happened. Now, this is a real issue. Certainly, we do know that there are intermediaries that do churn for the wrong reasons. But what we're concerned about is that this provision is trying to sort out a small element of the group that would do things for the wrong reason and, in fact, influencing a much broader perspective and messing with the principles. And to us, that is a problem. Also, just to mention that I think the way that the provision is worded here will have some implications, because we all know what happens. The devil's in the detail. And already we can see where there are loopholes in the way that it's worded that will be taken advantage of. We know what happens. And in fact, we just thought of a couple. I'm sure given time, other ones will arise, and other ways of getting around the provision will take place. And I don't think that's in anybody's interest for that to happen. We would certainly like to prevent that as much as possible. So just to go back to that issue about regulated versus unregulated, most of the underwritten policies in South Africa, all the underwritten policies in South Africa operate in a regulated environment around fees. That means that they may only charge as much as the regulation stipulates. We find generally that what happens is the maximum is charged, whatever said. In the unregulated environment, which relies very heavily on disclosure principles, it's much more open. You can charge whatever you like, but you have to completely and utterly disperse every last element of it to the client. And that's what's happened within the self-administered policies, which generally use unit trusts as the underlying vehicles. So we have an environment where you have two different mechanisms of what gets charged. And funny enough, you might think that the unregulated environment could be a dangerous one because you can charge anything you like. But because of the disclosure, what we find is, in fact, on the whole, less is charged overall, because everybody can see what's going on and you know exactly what you're paying when you pay your advisor. So we believe that the disclosure element works very well for clients, and that, in fact, the unregulated environment is a very suitable one. But I just mention it because it shows the differences between the way the policies are sold. So when we look at this paragraph, on paragraph 8, it pertains to three different potential situations where there could be a transfer. transfer A would be between an underwritten fund, sorry, A, U slash W stands for underwritten, to another underwritten fund. So in both instances, there would be commission paid for making the sale, potentially. The B version would be an underwritten fund being transferred to a self-administered fund, and C would be self-administered fund being transferred to another self-administered fund. Now, our understanding is that the Financial Services Board and National Treasury are particularly concerned about B. We might be wrong, but that's our perception, that where there's a move from the old-style life policies into the more modern, flexible policies in the self-administered environment, that what they want to make sure doesn't happen is that there are two levels of charges. That's our interpretation. I'm not sure if we're correct on that. The view in the broader intermediary industry is that a commission is generally charged for making the sale. In other words, for actually getting someone to put their signature to it and to make that investment. Whereas fees, on the whole, certainly within our environment, come on a different basis. We do have initial fees, which are for making the sale, but we also have something called an ongoing fee. It's often called a trail fee as well, and it's for advice, for instance, on portfolio construction. So it'll be once the money's in the portfolio, the client is approaching the age of 65, they've got to make a decision of what that portfolio looks like, and the advisor would assist them with perhaps moving to a more liquid version or putting more conservative elements or unit trusts within that portfolio. And that ongoing fee is charged once a year but explicitly disclosed on all documentation to the client. In our view, that fee is not linked to the purchase of the product. It's ongoing, and as I said, it's separately disclosed. Now, the way that paragraph 8 is currently proposed, we believe that there are many areas where it could be misinterpreted or there could be potential loopholes, and we certainly haven't thought of all of them, but we'll give you some of the ideas that we've thought of just in our industry. Okay, the first thing is the way it's worded at the moment, you could potentially have product providers continuing to earn fees while the advice provider doesn't get anything. Because the way it's worded, it says you can still charge anything up to what the maximum allowable commission was at the time of purchase. Now, if that transfer happens before the maximum allowable commission has been paid, it is potentially that there's still more commission that could be charged and that the product provider could get it. Another example of how it could be misinterpreted is in many instances, particularly in the self-administered funds, we have trustees who use investment advisors to give them advice on what their portfolio structure looks like. If we read in the strictest interpretation of this, we believe that, in fact, those trustees would not be allowed to pay an investment advisor for assistance on portfolio construction. And I think the duties on a trustee are quite onerous enough without having to take on that role as well. Then the other thing is at the time of transfer, it's going to be difficult to work out what the allowable charge was for the new fund that it's being transferred to and what, if any further fees can be charged. So both clients and advisors are in an awkward position where they're sitting with a fund that's being transferred. They don't know if they may charge anything further, whether it's viable for anything further to be charged on an ongoing basis, and what those proportions are. Another element where there could be potential problems is that there are a number of financial services providers in the FAS Act, certainly the definition of provider is also an area that could cause problems. We already have third-party funds in South Africa where we have independent brokers who launch their own unit trusts under the label of someone else, and this facilitates the payment of fees to them in the asset management leg. So what we're trying to say is you could stop on one element, but it doesn't mean to say that they weren't going to get a charge somewhere else. Then there's the issue about where funds, we know that in some instances people are talking about making the funds paid up and then restarting them somewhere else that allows them to get the commission anyway. And then, of course, the admin challenges of making partial payments, because our understanding is that if an advisor moves a client from an old-style fund to a new fund, that they can continue to charge fees on any new money added to that. Now, you can imagine the administrative difficulties of trying to work out what the new money is going forward as well. finally, just to mention that the way that it's worded, the it suggests that out-of-hand payments would be accepted for the advice as a way around this problem. I think just perhaps to mention that we believe that Treasury and Financial Services Board are looking long-term at introducing this as a concept in South Africa, where independent brokers would only have this as the only form of payment, where payment is made directly between the client and the broker. But at the moment, that is not the case. It's certainly not accepted. And the question is, should this particular one element invoke this particular way of payment right now? And also, whether there is any problem with the facilitation of payment through another provider, such as administrator. Does it make any difference as long as the client actually knows and has signed for what they're making the payment for? And it's very clearly disclosed. So it's a question of how that should be paid. And we're not sure that out-of-hand payments resolve the issue. So our conclusion is, yes, we completely agree with Treasury and FSB on this bill. There should be no further fees on a transfer for making the transfer or further commissions for making the sale. But we do not believe that ongoing advice does not apply to the entire portfolio. And therefore, an advice fee, we believe, should still be considered as an option for advisors to be remunerated for their services delivered, as long as the client has signed it off and understands completely the financial implications of that decision. So we're not sure then that perhaps what was meant is that the limit should apply only to underwritten funds. We're not sure. Perhaps that was the intention here. But we believe that there should also be no prohibition of facilitated personal payments. We don't believe it needs to be necessarily a check between one party and another. We believe that as long as that money is paid into the bank account, but the client is completely aware of it, there should be no problem on it, paid out of the fund itself. So we put our minds trying to work out how, in our view, this could perhaps be addressed in the paragraph that has been put forward here, and we've suggested that perhaps you could add the word personal instruction in the fourth line of the opening paragraph. So it would say no fees or commissions of any nature other than fees payable on the transferring member or non-member spouse's personal instruction, which we think is broader and applies to the situation. And then in sub-point two, perhaps if the intention is to refer specifically to underwritten funds, we should actually say that up front in the case of transfers from underwritten funds. And we believe that the word fees should be removed out of that section because we think it applies to ongoing advice fees, and we think it's muddying the principle of a sales fee, a sales commission, and an advice fee. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Can I then request that you can just move towards your left so that I can request the Association of Trust Companies in South Africa to come forward, because we'll take a discussion. We have a written submission from the Association of Trust Companies in South Africa, GFSL 12, and they are represented by Mrs. Adele Gold and Mr. Richard Kripelka. I see the third name of Jaleen von Dima. She's only going to answer questions. Okay. Welcome. The floor is yours.
Okay. Thank you, Chair. Thanks for the opportunity for the members as well to be able to make this presentation to yourself. In terms of the new legislation or the proposed legislation, we are fairly new in this industry in the sense that we have previously and up to now still been regulated by the Trust Property Control Act. So in terms of our deliberations with the regulator up to this stage,
We've been quite supportive of the legislation proposed, and we believe that seeing that we're focusing on beneficiary funds, which is the transition basically from the existing trust funds for employee benefit trusts, we're very supportive of the protection that beneficiaries require and regulation of this industry. And therefore, just to give a bit of background in terms of who we're representing, we're currently representing various trust companies that currently do employee benefits trusts. At this stage, it's estimated to be in excess of 15 billion rand, and that's belonging to over 300,000 to 400,000 beneficiaries. Okay, just in terms of the submission, where we have in front of you, we initially dealt with the commencement and transitional provisions of the bill, and in there, for instance, where it indicates that retirement funds can pay monies into this these beneficiary funds established on or after 1 January 2009. Obviously, there are concerns from outside in terms of implementation of that process, being able to register beneficiary funds to have them registered by that date. Also in terms of administration licenses and other requirements that we need to be able to be up and running and to carry on with business as usual by that date. So one of the recommendations in relation to that is to change Section 2A, instead of saying on or after 1 January, to change it to as at or after 1 January 2009 to allow us at least to be able to become licensed and register beneficiary funds to be able to accept payments into these beneficiary funds from January onwards. Okay, that's the one aspect. Moving on to the next one, we're looking at the powers of beneficiary fund trustees. As you may be aware, in the traditional employee benefit trust, the responsibility of trustees of those particular vehicles have the responsibility of evaluating monthly payments to beneficiaries and guardians for survival and for maintenance, as well as ad hoc discretionary capital payments, which is in relation to education, medical, and any other expenses that these beneficiaries may incur. And as currently the Pension Funds Act is stated, as well as the bill, there is no provision in there for giving the trustees these specific powers in order to make the payments from the assets of these beneficiaries. So that is one particular aspect we need to deal with urgently. And also in terms of the other powers of these trustees, obviously, we deal with the situation where there are deposits made, where you have ongoing needs of beneficiaries, yet you have to have a sort of a long-term approach to investments in order to ensure you can do sufficient investments, but yet be able to deal with short-term needs of beneficiaries. So that's obviously an area we're very particular about as well. And then further to that, the trustees then need to. Beneficiary fund trustees need then to pass on those instructions and delegate these powers to the administrators of these beneficiary funds to be able to execute all these activities that needs to be done on a fairly frequent and regular basis for beneficiaries. It's not like your retirement fund where you're going to have your withdrawal or your contributions once a month. It becomes quite complex in terms of having to deal with all requirements and demands from beneficiaries and making sure these are efficiently administered. Okay, moving on to Section 37A of the Pension Funds Act. Obviously, also in there, we need to make provisions, like I mentioned before, in terms of allowing beneficiary fund trustees to be able to make this capital payment, and that it shouldn't constitute a prohibited reduction of the benefit. In terms of ownership of assets, currently under the Trust Property Control Act and the way trust funds have been registered with the master to date, the assets placed in the trust vest in the beneficiaries. And what is happening currently with the proposal of the beneficiary fund is that the assets will vest in the fund and not in the beneficiaries. So it's an indication of we're moving from a situation where the assets belong to the beneficiaries and are now going to belong to the fund. So that's a very fundamental change in the way this is going to be viewed. In the previous discussion, it was suggested maybe at some stage that it should be considered that a separate vehicle be created in terms of legislation to allow these beneficiaries to actually own the assets and not have it owned by the fund. But that's still open for discussion. So with the situation with these assets now not being vesting in the beneficiaries, we're dealing with a tax situation where previously with it vesting in them and based on the average size of trust and the average income earned by these beneficiaries,
they would 99.9% fall under the income tax bracket and therefore do not pay any tax. And then with the situation of it belonging to the fund, obviously the whole tax situation came into play in terms of how it should be taxed. Should the fund be taxed? Is it reasonable to tax the fund? Is it fair that these beneficiaries should incur these tax liabilities? So that's another aspect we're concerned about. And similarly, when the assets were vesting in the beneficiary, when these beneficiaries, for instance, if a beneficiary passed on before he becomes a major, before he becomes entitled to the assets, we would, because it's vested in them, we would then pay it into the estate of the beneficiary, or in the sense where under the age of 16 you're not allowed to have a legal will, we would then follow the legislation in relation to interstate succession. And obviously, again, with the beneficiary fund owning these assets, that matter becomes complicated, and we need some resolve around that. Okay, moving on to the next aspect, dealing with transfer of existing trust. We're not quite clear how both or how the regulator intends implementing that from the point of view that we are now talking about an asset that is vested in a beneficiary that we're now going to transfer into a fund where it's not going to belong to the beneficiary. And obviously that's a serious contradiction in terms of how it's going to work. And we're not sure that, you know, legally you can actually reverse the vesting of the benefit in the beneficiary fund, which is now in the fund. Moving on to transfer benefits from one beneficiary fund to another, which is also proposed. We do understand that there would be no Section 14 requests in terms of that particular transfer, but it's also not clear in terms of what circumstances retirement funds would be permitted to actually make these transfers to a different beneficiary fund administrator or a different beneficiary fund, and also, you know, what should be the guidelines for retirement funds in terms of making those kind of decisions. Obviously, we've got to bear costs in mind and all other corporate governance and that kind of thing, but we also have to consider the interests of the beneficiaries, knowing and understanding that it is because of these assets normally being placed in trust for guardians are not capable of managing these assets, the level of financial literacy is not very high, and moving assets from one administrator and fund to the other, I don't think it's going to make their lives very easy. Okay. So yeah, we just need some clarity around that as well. And then moving on to the license requirements for administrators, obviously that hasn't been cleared. We expect that there's some clarification for that in the regulations that will be supported for that. We just also need the understanding that current trust companies would need sufficient time to be able to gear up for those requirements, to be able to register and obtain these licenses with the regulator as well. And then in terms of what the situation is currently, if you had to pay out capital from a retirement fund in the sense of obtaining tax directives to be able to do that, considering the fact that for beneficiary funds you can make between 2 to 10 capital payments per annum for a beneficiary, and the onus on an administrator or board of trustees to apply for tax directives in each of those instances is going to be quite problematic. As you can imagine, it will be quite cost ineffective, and it could possibly also cause significant delays in terms of getting these payments through to beneficiaries, bearing in mind that often these assets are paid, for instance, to universities, institutions of education, where there are specific deadlines in terms of when these payments need to be made in order to make sure the child or the beneficiary can actually attend. So those things are going to be quite a problem for us to resolve. And then just looking at costs going forward, in our discussions and deliberations, and bearing in mind the cost that are already applied in terms of administration to these assets belonging to beneficiaries, it has been proposed that they should be exempt from FSB and adjudicator levies, and we just hope that that will be the case going forward in confirming the regulations. Okay, and then just dealing with exemptions, being beneficiary funds being new under the Pension Funds Act, or under the BOLD, which is part of that, there are lots of areas of the Pension Funds Act currently
and the way it is intended for these beneficiary funds to be administered and regulated, that wouldn't apply to what the intention is, and therefore we would assume that the regulator would use its powers proposed in the bill to be able to make sure that we can structure the exemptions to make the administration of these funds as effectively and workable as possible. Thank you, and that's it for me.
Any additions from Nicola? Thank you very much. That's it. We've taken these two submissions. Questions, comments, others? Mr. Lord, Dr. George.
Thank you, Chair. Mine are just two minor ones to the Association of Trust Companies in South Africa. You're saying that you require certain exemptions because you might find that your situation might not be applicable to the norm, so to say. Is it possible just to give us not an exhaustive list, but just an illustration of that? In what way would you find it difficult to comply with the whole Act? Last one, Chair, it's just on administrators. I just want to find out how are they currently regulated. Do you feel that they are adequately regulated?
Dr. George? Thank you, Chair. My question is for the Association of Unit Trust. On the ongoing advice fee, my understanding is it works as follows. You purchase an investment, and then you pay the advisor upfront. And then there's an ongoing trailer fee calculated on an annual basis and then paid monthly. Now, surely it would depend on the portfolio that you're in whether you should pay advice fee or not, because if you're in a particular portfolio that never changes, for example, then you're not getting any advice, therefore you shouldn't pay a fee. If you are in a portfolio that is changeable and you are getting advice to change it, perhaps wouldn't it be better to pay when you actually get the advice? Thank you, Chair.
In terms of possible exemptions we're looking at, for instance, if you look at the Pension Funds Act and how membership is defined, for instance, along the lines of employee versus employer relationship, in beneficiary funds you don't have that. The beneficiaries are dependents of the deceased member. If you look at areas like Section 37C, in terms of the death of a beneficiary, there's no way that it can be expected of a board of trustees of a beneficiary fund trustees to search for dependents of a minor, and in most instances a minor wouldn't have dependents. So those kind of distributions wouldn't apply. Section 14 is not appropriate. Liquidation, I mean, there cannot be a liquidation of a beneficiary fund. There are always beneficiaries, and those beneficiaries need to be paid their assets. There cannot be a liquidation. And those are just a few, but they're definitely a whole lot more. That's on the exemptions. And moving on to current legislation, as you may all be aware, it's been widely covered in the media over the past few years in light of the Prudential and Livingham situation. Even though we are currently regulated by the Trust Property Control Act under the mask of the High Court, it has been viewed as being significantly insufficient, and that the level of protection for beneficiaries in that is also insufficient. And even though we would register certain initial documentations with the master as well as trustees, I suppose the following up and financial management of trust hasn't been sufficiently supervised.
Mr. Chairman, may I make a comment on that? The other issue is that we are phase regulated, which is the more recent legislation, which is probably more compelling and demanding legislation at the moment. So all trust administrators performing an administration service and acting as administrators have to be appropriately licensed in terms of the current phase legislation. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Collective investment.
Thank you, Dr. George. The question really, I think, goes to the heart of the matter of why we are concerned about the lack of differentiation between the underwritten environment with regulated commission maxima and the the self-administered environment where you do not have regulation for fees at any level of the value chain, whether it's at the product provider level or the advice level. Fundamentally, the key differential that we need to, make between the two ways in which you can make provision for a retirement annuity type product, a personal pension type product, is that in the underwritten environment, fees are regulated and charged up front, and that does that extends beyond just the environment of advice or a commission for distribution that is paid to an intermediary. It also extends to the fee earned by the product provider. So effectively what happens is that in an underwritten environment, you have a bundled fee that pays for, a bundled charge, rather, against the client that pays for a variety of services, including administration and the provision of the product, but also theoretically the ongoing service to the advisor. Contractually, that is now charged up front. And typically in a personal pension type environment, it is quite likely that you could have a 20, 30, 40-year term to the eventual use of the assets at the time of retirement. In the self-administered environment, you're dealing with an unbundled value chain where it's very clear what you are paying for the different components, being financial advice, administration, and investment management that really make up the essence of a personal pension product. And the client at any given point in time has the ability to vary any of those charges because it's taken on an as and when basis. Typically, over the term, the total costs would be fairly similar between the two environments, with a fundamental difference that in the self-administered environment, the client has the option to terminate any component of the value chain at any given point in time. So the advice to deal more specifically with the question with regard to surely it seems more logical for the client to only pay for advice when received at that point. I think there's three parts to the answer. The first part to the answer is that a very significant component of the advice is the regular and ongoing review to ensure that the portfolio remains appropriate for the financial situation of the client. So the financial planning component of the process is not static, and a very significant component of the value add of the financial advisor or the intermediary is to ensure that the portfolio of assets owned by the client is still appropriate for their requirements. And what you have in the self-administered environment is that, again, because you have an unbundled value chain, the concept of administration and the concept of investment have been separated. You have all self-administered personal pension products, retirement annuity funds, to my knowledge, provide investment choice and a fairly wide range of investment choice. And that enables the intermediary to, as the situation of the financial situation of the client changes, to adjust the portfolio by making use of the variety of investment options that are available on the platform. So the products are structurally designed to provide the opportunity for ongoing changes to the portfolio when required by financial position. And when we talk about portfolio construction, it's worthwhile to emphasize that it's not necessarily an issue or varying the exposure to different parts of the markets by chasing returns, as it were, by trying to maximize the investment outcomes by being in different investments at different times. It's not only about advice fees, aren't only for investment choices, but to ensure the appropriateness of portfolio for the meeting of client needs. So I think that's a very important point. And finally, I've made the one on the difference between an unregulated environment with unbundled fees taken on an ongoing as and when basis that can be terminated immediately versus one where fees are charged upfront for the entire period with no ability to differentiate that. But I think the final point that is important to make is that what we find very iniquitous in the proposed paragraph 8 at the moment is the differentiation in treatment between product providers and intermediaries. And I think it's worthwhile to conclude with this point, that if the same logic that is applied in paragraph 8 at the moment to intermediary remuneration is applied to product provider remuneration, you should also not allow the providers of self-administered underwritten annuities to earn any revenue on the transfer of business out of an underwritten retirement annuity, because it's exactly the same principle that applies here. The rationale as to why there's the potential for a double commission really relates to an arguable flaw in the structuring of the way that revenue is charged in the underwritten product, and we just find it difficult to understand why two charges that effectively in principle work on exactly the same basis are differentiated on that basis. So if the House sees their way fit to allow the product provider to earn fees, we think that the House should also see their way fit to allow the intermediaries to earn a fee.
Can I just add one point, because I thought George made a very good point about why should you pay a fee if your portfolio stays the same. I think that's where a good financial advisor can really add value at times, because often we find that clients actually want to swap portfolios, and they've heard about the latest unit trust performing well, and they want to move into it. And in fact, it could be exactly the wrong thing to do. So sometimes the best advice a financial advisor can give is keep your portfolio the same.
Thank you. Just to follow up, sorry, I took note. I just want to know, is it normal for an advisor fee to be charged when you've got an investment portfolio? Just every month you look at your statement, or quarterly you see advisor fee, but for years you don't get any advice? It's in my own case. Maybe
I suggest you fire your advisor.
And half the time you can't find these advisors because they belong to banks and things like that.
It's all in the agreement.
You will speak directly to the product provider and get them to remove that fee immediately. They can do that for you.
That's an interesting thing. And very few people would be able to spot that and be able to speak to them to stop that. Okay. National Treasury, FSB, any points you would want to clarify? Your response is on the 27th, so don't mistake this opportunity for your responses. Joanne?
Thank you. And we won't abuse the privilege that you've given us. The only thing that I want to comment on relates to the regulators. Baron also just has one or two clarifications, and then Jürgen also, we just like to, from the pension side, comment on two points that were raised. I think in respect of the coordinating of between regulators, I think the industry is well aware that the Minister of Finance has launched a specific project to further enhance coordination between regulators and to ensure that there's consistency of powers and consistency in application across the regulators. But as Baron pointed out during the briefing, it is an ongoing process. It's not possible to do it in one big bang. And that's why, as we can improve the legislation, we are doing so. We do take the point in respect of maybe entrenching in the legislation some consultation with other regulators, specifically where, for instance, in the bank's instance, that there is a clear recognition that the one regulator can consult the other regulator in respect of the fit and proper issues. But there is, and Jürgen will further elaborate, from a regulator's perspective, specifically in terms of current coordination going on. And I think the other point that I would like to raise, and that extends to the financial year, we'll definitely ensure that there is congruency in terms of where a financial year is approved by one regulator, that the other regulator is nearly informed. So that's not that these two approvals required. And I think the one issue is that, on the one hand, and specifically from the Banking Association, it seems that they feel when we could affect or impact on their business, we must consult the other regulators. But when we secure information that might be very relevant to other regulators, they don't want us to share that on inspection. So, I mean, there is some sort of a contradiction in that approach. And I do think, sort of in the broader review, those are all the issues that we will look at. But just to highlight to the committee that that is a primary objective of what Treasury is looking at going forward. Darren?
Actually, today I can actually see some grey here. You were right that it has to do with the lighting in that room. Unless you touched it a bit, I don't know what you said.
Chair, I added some suitable highlights of the commentary from the committee. I'm glad to see it's working now. No longer to be referred to as young man. Good parts and bad parts to that. In the interest of time, I mean, a lot of the issues we're dealing with are complex, and sometimes we only scratch this. We do scratch the surface, but it's the job of a lot of us here to go down and drill to the very details to sort those things out. On divorce orders, I'd like the committee to note that there are four legs to this issue, and the committee should think about those four legs, and that were highlighted by the people who spoke today. One is, or maybe one wasn't. Three definitely were. One is administrative cost. So, yes, this will impose an administrative cost to execute on paying the divorce orders that go pre-13 September. True. Another aspect is leakage from the system that was raised by the LOA. Yes, there will be leakage if the divorcee doesn't transfer to another fund and elects to take the money. But you must also look at that within the context of our current pension funds environment, which doesn't have compulsory preservation. So if you as a primary member leave your fund, you take your money. So until, as I see it, we change that law, which may very well be the part of pension fund reform going forward, I see it as very difficult to deny the third leg, or the last leg I want to mention rather, which is the non-member spouse in this. Now, I've sat on a phone for half an hour listening to someone crying in my ear, pleading as to how they can get hold of this money. It's very difficult for me to answer that person or refer them appropriately. And that's the aspect that wasn't highlighted enough today in the presentations. With respect to the Principal Officers Association, I'm disappointed to see that the people who should hear what I'm going to say are not here. So I don't know if it's preaching to the converted, but there's a difference between vetting an appointment, which is what the registrar is given the power to do, as highlighted by Mr. Molotta and others, and actually appointing the person. And the registrar is not given in the draft bill the power to appoint the person. It's clearly a vetting exercise. And that's simply a check by the registrar, because perhaps the trustee board is not even aware of certain things that their candidates have done, but the registrar is. And we think it's appropriate that the registrar could say, listen, I know something you don't. On fees and commissions, or section 14.7, this is a very complicated issue, as we highlighted in the debate of September last year. Regulating costs and commissions is not a first best solution to something. Improving competition and disclosure is a first best solution. But we're coming from a history of where we had regulated, in the underwritten environment, we've had regulated commissions, and it's about how do we move forward from that environment where, sure, the vast majority of intermediaries acted appropriately, but there were also others that didn't, and hence the debate began. And we should also highlight a second feature, which is that commission review, because commission doesn't only relate to the transfer between retirement annuities, it's also commission on endowments, for instance. That process of commission review is a parallel process, so something that goes beyond section clause 14.7. And something that Treasury is working on, we've in fact released draft regulations on that section, proposing to alter the way commissions are regulated and paid to, for instance, provide for an advice fee. So, for instance, if you don't receive advice on an ongoing basis or for an advice commission, if you don't receive if you don't receive service for that, you can actually redirect your commission to someone who will give you service. But I don't want to talk too much on that because, obviously, time is limited. But on beneficiary funds, we'd just like to say most of the issues raised by the Association of Trust Companies are addressed in some way. And yes, you may say that there's devil in the detail, but we don't legislate for every single minor detail. That's the job of the regulator to then fill in some of the gaps, some of the very, you know, what form do I have to fill in, how is this actually going to work, what are the trustees going to do, and those sort of things. On the tax side, we would urge you to engage with, I don't represent our tax unit, and hopefully I can speak for them, But we urge you to engage with our tax people. It's a matter we flag for them, so they have to address it in upcoming taxation laws, amendment bills before beneficiary funds would actually be able to take effect, so that issue can be taken care of. And the last issue is on the date of effect, which is suggested in the bill to be 1 January 2009. Now, that's I mean, the entire bill is for debate in this committee, and that date is no exception. The date is there, but nothing is cast in stone. If people and this committee believe that it should not be 1 January or that is unreasonably soon, then you're free to decide on the matter. Remember, the bill has been in drafting for quite some time, so there's debate around what the appropriate date should be. But that there should be a date, I don't think there's disagreement between us and yourself. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. I wanted to comment on a couple of issues that were raised from a regulatory perspective. But Baron, despite you being a national treasurer, you spoke like a true regulator on some of those issues. Chair, I just want to then just limit my comments from an SSB perspective and speaking as part of the executive of the SSB. It would be irresponsible of us as a regulator to operate like an ostrich with our heads in the sand, that where we find an issue, it's just an FSB issue and it's nobody else's issue. We have arrangements of cooperation with all regulators. It's important that we have these arrangements of cooperation. In fact, in our briefing the other day, it was mentioned a number of times that we've got Section 22, which allows us to share information with fellow regulators. And there are ongoing meetings with fellow regulators. When we do pick up something in our environment that impacts on our fellow regulator, one of the first things we do is make sure we contact the other regulator. We have formal meetings between regulators where we share information. So I just want to put aside this notion that this doesn't exist in the regulatory space. It's important from South Africa perspective that regulators do in fact interact on this basis. Thank you, Chair.
And is this engagement regulated in the memorandum of understanding? Any other formal?
Chair, we have formal MOUs in place with certain regulators, and there are that type of formal thing, and we have formal meetings that are set up and ongoing meetings with fellow regulators.
Okay. Thank you very much. The submissions we had today were only a few of the many that have come forward. And when we take responses, that's why I said don't be tempted to use this opportunity to respond. There are many others that the National Treasury and the Health and the Committee have. So when you respond, you take responses to all of them. I take this opportunity to thank all of you for having come before us. I trust that your inputs have enriched the process and it's going to assist us in making an informed decision going forward. I trust that the legislation that is going to come out of this process is going to be to the benefit of both the industry and the consumer. Thanks. Thank you all, members. FSB, National Treasury, Banking Association, Customs Association, Life Officers Association, everyone, Parliament, Legal Assistance. I'm told there is light lunch. I do not want to comment on how healthy it is, but but that brings us to the end of this session. The meeting is adjourned. Thank you very much. We meet again, members, on Tuesday. Wednesday. What did I do with the program? We meet again Tuesday, and I just want to check what the venue is and whether we still have the same program. We meet Tuesday the 20th, where we are going to have hearings on the budget votes, starting with National Treasury on Tuesday, SARS on Wednesday, and SA on Friday the 23rd. And we will take a response on this one on the 27th, Tuesday. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you.